Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You're listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Imam Alfred, and I'm super excited that we have with us the Honorable Dr. Floyd Phillips. Dr. Phillips is an eminent psychoanalyst, scholar, and one of the foremost thinkers of our time. He's currently working on a book, The Making of a Black African-American Psychoanalyst, that is going to be, I know, a bestseller, because he can tell you how to make a mayonnaise sandwich and turn it into three Columbia University degrees. We there's an old saying in the African-American community, in particular African-American church, God would make a way out of no way. And Dr. Phillips is an example of that. A practicing psychoanalyst, scholar, teacher, writer. And we're just honored and tickled pink, as the word were to go, to have him on our program. We're going to teach out some very important issues, including the issue of a recent article that was in the Atlantic Monthly. Dr. Phillips, welcome to Religion Means Alive, and I'd like if you would be so kind enough to give us an opening statement.
Well, thank you, Imam Muhammad, for having me on here. It's a pleasure to be here once again. And, you and I talk at length about psychoanalysis and psychology as it pertains to the African-American and people of color in general. We both have explored and looked at Dr. Joy DeCruz's work on PTSD in the black community, or post-traumatic slave syndrome, as she coined the phrase, and tried to look at the significance and relevance, if any, to it. And so this article that this young man, Tanish, I believe his name is, quotes, wrote, has some significance in terms of reparations, because the question that some conservative white Americans would ask the question, is it really necessary? I mean, that's over. Slavery was gone, has been gone 150 years. Why are we dealing with this nonsense now? And, you know, and we've had affirmative action, so what's the relevance of it? But the relevance of it, and I agree with what this gentleman touched on in the article, is the relevance of it is, although slavery doesn't exist in the form that it did 150 years ago, the policies and behavior that castrated the African-American male and just made the family dysfunctional and fragmented still exists today. For example, today as we speak, there are people in Congress who want to cut back on summer lunch programs. And what's so powerful about this is they want to cut back on the inner city and urban summer lunch programs for poor kids. For poor kids, and, you know, there's a certain number of African Americans that fall in this. But here's the interesting part, which kind of suggests maybe we ought to look at race again, because he wants to have it. The children in the Appalachian, which is 95% white, excluded. They can still get summer lunch. And so, you know, you have to ask yourself, what's the relevance of this as opposed to poor kids throughout America? I want all poor kids to eat. And so this is the same mindset, the same policies that exist. You don't have to just starve a person physically to kill them or to make them sick, but if you starve a person intellectually and emotionally, then, you know, you can also make them sick. So when our schools are so substandard and the opportunity don't exist in our community like it does other places, it causes a breakdown. The only opportunity that really exists consistently in our communities today is the opportunity to go to some of these substandard dysfunctional schools, which seems to have a pipeline right to prison. So that there is a reason that the opportunities and other things don't exist in our prison, but yet we have almost 50% of the population in most cities in prisons are African Americans and Latinos. So you know, these things, when people talk about reparations and they say, that was 150 years ago. I applaud the Jewish community because, you know, it can be 1,000 years from now, but they will never let you forget and minimize the Holocaust. And I applaud them for that. That's a wonderful thing because that kind of assures them that that will never happen again. So, you see, in many respects, we had intact families right after slavery. When slavery ended, when you go to the 20s and 30s in America, there was a large number of African Americans. I don't have the numbers in front of me, so I'm going to have to use the word large, but there were a large number of African American families that were intact, mother, father, and children. Okay? And, you know, that has sort of broken down now. You know, and there's a reason for that, for a lot of reasons, but the number one reason for divorce in America, number one, is finance. Number one, the number one strain.
Paul, you are young enough to remember, they said romance without finance is a nuisance.
Right. Absolutely.
So it is an important piece. But we're talking about 15 generations. That's not a lot of generations, at most, from slavery. My great grandmother, I cite her often, Lula Nallen, God bless her, I remember her, was born in slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
As I've been writing a psychobiography myself, a kind of auto psychobiography, I had to wonder why I'm in the situation I'm in terms of the psychological state, and I gave myself a big pat on the back. My grandmother was a slave. So it's no small wonder that my grandmother, my mother, Virgin Mae Desmond, whose mother abandoned her and took the boys with her, who had herself experienced separation. It was easy for my grandmother to separate from her children. She had learned separation. She had grown up on a plantation where half of her brothers went one place and the other half went other places. So I think that the people say, well, hold up, you just got out of slavery. I mean, the slavery was 150 years ago. But I don't think you can tell that to the Irish. The Irish are still battling what the British did to them because they're still psychologically burdened by that. So as a psychoanalyst, I heard in the word reparation also the word repairing. And I hate to say this. I don't mean no harm in saying this. I find you more equipped to deal with these issues than our dear friend, Sister Joyce, Dr. Joyce. Her name was O'Leary, I think her name the guy, whatever. But I've heard her, and I must tell her, even on a week discussion before we have a cup of coffee, we have already probed the psychological depths of slavery and urban dislocation. Would you comment on that?
I don't know. I think Dr. DeCree's background is in sociology. I'm not sure. I don't think it's psychology. She can certainly speak to being an African American, having dealt with a certain amount of racism and what she's observed and even done some research on. But what I would like to say is I've kind of lived this in a different way from the inner city up. As you know, I don't have a high school diploma. I dropped out of high school and
You have a doctorate and you don't have a high school diploma. Explain that to our audience.
Well, I grew up in Harlem, and I think you certainly know this story. I've mentioned it to you a few times. And my mother died when I was 11 years old, and my father suffered from pneumonic conosilicosis, which was a debilitating lung disease. Not only affected his lungs, but he had the bends, which affected his joint, as a result of 33 years of sand hog work, working under the ground, deep under the ground, and the pressure affected his joints. So my father required a lot of medical attention, and my mother died when we were all young, so we had to make an attempt to give it to him. And, of course, there was a lot of poverty at that time, and we didn't have a lot of money, so we had limited resources, limited knowledge, and we kind of had to do the best we can to take care of them. So what happened was there seemed to be a lot more opportunities in the street than it was, you know, working for, I believe at that time the minimum wage was a dollar an hour or a dollar and a quarter hour, I'm not sure, but somewhere in that vein. And then when they take taxes out, well, you know, so there seemed to be a lot more opportunity in the street, and therefore my older brother, who was 1 year older than me, he went to the street, and then I kind of got pulled into that, and so we hung out there as long as we could, and he subsequently died at a young age. He died at 19. No, he actually died at 20, and 1 year after his birthday in 1972. And it was then that I began to feel that, well, first I didn't have anybody that had my back in the street, because you got to have some friends in the street. You really can't do this by yourself out there. And also, too, as my brother had said, I wasn't built for heavy lifting. So, you know, my ability to be aggressive was somewhat limited compared to the real aggressive people out there. And you certainly need some of that in your corner if you don't, you can't go but so far. So it was that, at that point, that I began to think about, you know, not staying in the street but making a transition to something else that I could do and make some money. And at that time, my father was still living, and his health had really debilitated, but being older and being a little bit wiser, we were able to draw in some resources. There were a little bit more resources now. At that time, I think Medicaid had kicked in, and we were able to get Medicaid for him and some other stuff. And so we were able to get a visiting nurse and stuff like that. But we had some limited resources, and so we made do with what we can. But I was able then to think and try to do some work, but work didn't pay anything, and I was just working for nothing. You know, I'd come home, and I really had to budget and save money, and I'm trying to see, well, where do I go from here? I always remembered that my mother and grandmother, who was the matriarch of the family, you mentioned your grandmother, Lula. Well, my grandmother, Ella Mills DeShazer, her mother was born in slavery, and her mother fortunately told her stories about slavery, and she relayed those to me and my brother and sister many occasions. So I got first-hand or second-hand information, but which was pretty reliable. What I was also very impressed with was how she didn't have any bitterness for the way that they treated their mother, the way those people had treated her mother. You know, I mean, when people tell you stories about how they were abused, beaten, if they misbehave, I mean, a woman being beaten, you know, stuff like that, or a woman made to have sex so she could have children, you know, it turns your stomach and it kind of makes you angry. But she didn't really express a lot of outward anger toward these people. I certainly know that she kept one eye on them, so to speak. Like, you know, if you're looking to trust them, you're crazy, or you can't trust them all. Certainly, there were some folks that she got along with and had treated her fairly. There's no question about that. And her being a Christian woman, she acknowledged that. And I think one of the reasons, since I mentioned that, that she didn't have a lot of business because she let go and let God. She let God fight her battles, and, you know, he felt that the wicked, he would take care of them. So I think that religion held her together and didn't allow her to be vindictive. But in any event, I remembered that, and I did, for the first 6 years of my life or first 10 years of my life, you know, I did fairly well in school, and that was always applauded and fostered from my grandmother's point of view and my mother's. But my grandmother, she was the one who would take us to Sunday school in the summertime, other kids vacation in the summertime, not us. We had to go to Bible school in the summertime, and we would get out at 3 o'clock, and we'd still get a chance to come back and do some playing. But, you know, I remember walking past my friends, and they're going to the schoolyard, we're going to Bible school. So it was kind of interesting. But that also proves that, you know, if you bend the tree when it's young, it's going to tend to grow in that direction. So no matter how many storms it gets in, it's going in that direction. And that kind of what dawned on me as I got older. You know, I'm a pretty smart guy. I'm not dumb. I I was well behaved in school, so I got along well with the teachers and other people. And I kind of went back to a program on 125th Street at that time called the College Adaptive Program. There was a guy named Donald Hamilton, I believe, running it, if I'm not mistaken. And then I went on to graduate from there. I went to City College, and I got a bachelor's degree in psychology. And that was sort of the beginning, because I was always curious about the human mind. My quest for life was, when I was a child, I used to wonder, okay, I know why I'm not happy, because I don't control anything. I don't have anything. I don't know. You couldn't pick me up and put me in another state and say, okay, you're on your own and survive. I had nothing. But I couldn't figure out, for the love of me, why adults were miserable. Most of the adults around me were miserable. Most of the adults around me didn't have anything. And that used to perplex me. And I would say, well, God, you had 40 years on this planet to get this right. 50 years, how is it that? So that always stuck in my mind. If everyone wants to be happy, then why aren't people happy? And that kind of led me to psychology. And I didn't openly express this question, but I would just observe. And I would say, you know, when I became an adult, that's not going to happen to me. So I kind of learned as I got older that, well, that's easier said than done. You have genetic things going for you and against you, and you also have learned behavior that may not be working for you. You know, nobody grows up in a perfect environment, not even a rich kid. He doesn't grow up in a perfect environment. He may be given a lot of things, but there's other things that's going on inside of him, including genetics, that may work against him. I had a patient who was well-educated and did a lot of good things. I mean, he was an off-Broadway producer, and I told you about this guy before. He was a white guy from the Midwest. And no matter what he did, he pulled off an off-Broadway production that the New York Times gave very good write-ups to. But, you know, about 3 or 4 weeks after the production, he was laying on the couch in my office during a session. He said, you know, I'm really a failure. I mean, anybody could have done that. That wasn't, that wasn't anything grand. You know, I wish I'd gotten more out of life. I wish I could do more. So he wasn't able to hold any feelings of accomplishment too long. Right after the presentation, he kind of felt good. He didn't jump up and down, but you could see a little smile here and there. And he was saying, well, thank God it didn't go worse, and look what the New York Times said. So that was good, but he couldn't hold that too long. Part of that, and I'm going to get back to my little story, but part of that, Alfred, is they're very young. You know, we don't teach kids how to handle adversity and setbacks. You know, we don't. We also berate them when they're little that you can never do nothing, and you're just like your father. And so, you know, we do that. And by the time the kid is like 12, 13, that's in there. So then we become afraid to try. We look at failures as devastation. But remember, the Asians say that danger is a symbol for opportunity. They have the same symbol for both things. So, you know, that's something that we have to do, and that's something that's one of the reasons that I think that we in the argument or the exploration for reparations, we can look at that effect that had on us in slavery. I mean, 300 years of people telling you you're nothing, you're subhuman, you can't possibly succeed at anything, and if you do, it's eventually going to be messed up. I mean, did that have an effect? So, once I went back to City College, I went to City College, and of course, in that process of going to City College, it actually took me 5 years to get out of a 4-year school because I had to stop twice. Absolutely, positively, no money, and I took a leave of absence to work the first time, and then the second time I took a leave of absence, I really, really wasn't planning to come back. You know, really wasn't planning to come back, and as fate had it, I got a full-time job working in Bloomingdale's in New York City, and the two people that worked over me, actually, the first person that I worked under treated me very, very badly. But regardless of that, I got to stay on full time because this was Christmas help I got a job with. And they hired me full time in the shoe department. I believe it was on the fourth floor. And the buyer and assistant buyer were two women, and they both had MBAs. I never will forget that because that's when I first started to pay attention to MBAs, Masters of Business Administration. And they were making phenomenal money. They were jet setters. and there was a rumor floating around that they were jet setters and they were getting high on something, but, you know, it was just a rumor. And these two women were so, I mean, they would just say all kind of stuff to you. Are you, can you work any slower? My God, can you move over there, get over there? You put those on the wrong wall. For Christ's sake, you know, really. And I had a guy that worked in another part of the shoe department on the other side of the floor, and we shared the same stock room. And when they would get finished saying these cruel things and being nasty to me, this guy I had talked to a few times, and I told him that I was on a leave of absence from college, and I was thinking about not going back. And when they would finish this and they would walk away, he would come by and he would say in a very soft voice while he was, like, working, not even look at me, but say in a soft voice, the only difference between you and them is they got a college degree. If you had a college degree, you would be in charge of this stock room. And that was so powerful. And, you know, first I ignored it, but after they did it, it seemed like some spiritual entity in the universe was sending this guy there to say that to me. And so one day when I got fed up, I quit. And I called my guidance counselor up, and I asked him, was it too late to come back to school? Name was David McDonald. And he said, you know, that's interesting. I was supposed to put your papers in to, you know, terminate you because you were supposed to be back here last week, and you didn't. So, and I said, well, don't put the papers in. I'll be up, Mr. McDonald. When can I come? He said, you got to come today so I can put them in today. And I went up that day and put them in. And I then finished City College, and then went on to work for the city. So that's basically how I did, you know, went to City College and finished that. This is my first degree. I was very proud of that degree. And then subsequently started to go to the Tree of Life bookstore in Harlem and talk to people, and we had a lot of street scholars there. I tell people all the time I have another doctorate from UCLA. And I tell them, but it's not the UCLA you know of in California. This is the UCLA in Harlem, the university on the corner of Lenox Avenue. And I learned a lot there from the street scholars, from real wise men, and even from some of the Nation of Islam folks that I used to talk to. So there was a lot of education in that respect. And you say all the time, and I agree with 100%, the greatest master's degree you're ever going to get is the one where you master yourself. Know your strengths, know your weaknesses, know how to embrace your weaknesses, know how to move past adversity, because everybody's going to have adversity. Who are you? How do you see yourself? What are you running to, or what are you running from? And more importantly, how are you doing it? Passive-aggressively? Denial? So all these things go into it. This is one of the reasons why I've always gravitated towards psychology and kind of embrace it. I went to work for the city. I ended up getting a scholarship for Columbia University School of Social Work. And I don't mind telling you, Imam Muhammad, the first semester that I got there, when I used to take exams, my hands would tremble because I didn't go to any private school like most of those students there did. I wasn't I didn't score 1,000 on the SATs and things like that there. So it was very interesting. There was only one African-American woman in my class at that time, I believe. And if it wasn't, it was two. That was tops. But no, I only had one in the class when I first got there, I think. And so what happened was the first paper I handed in, he wouldn't even put a grade on. He said, I really want you to pay, you know, attention to the assignment and rewrite this one. So I left there and I went home. I felt real bad. And I said to myself, they're going to throw me out of here. I don't belong here with these people. But what I did was really give myself time. I did not know how to study like that, what they wanted. There was a difference in what they wanted and what you would normally get on a college level. And so I really went back and...
How did you learn that?
How did I learn what? Imam?
Yes.
How did I learn what?
You know, because that was a big problem for me, too, in college. And having come out of a GED program, I really didn't have the study skills for things that were difficult. There were some subjects that were quite easy for me, and I just wondered how you developed those study skills. I'm sure you didn't have them in the home, and then you went on to earn a bachelor's and a master's degree. Go ahead and tell us how you learned study techniques.
Right. Well, okay, remember that studying is a subjective thing. So it depends on the individual. But what I would do is, the first thing I'd do is be very clear on what I was looking for, what I was being asked. I had to learn not to sit down and read a textbook as though it was a comic book. Just read it and think, I'm looking for specific things. Then I had to look at how I think or how I respond to them. How do I answer these questions? So that's, you know, the answers that you get in life are going to depend on a great deal on the questions that's asked. So what was I being asked, and was I clear on that, and then how do I answer it? And then I learned from reading and trying to look at study things, study guides, that, you know, everything has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I'm a real big person on keeping things simple. You know, I'd love to expound on things and go, but the best thing is to keep it simple. And so if you hit that beginning, that middle, and that end, and make sure you answered that question, you know, you've got 75% of that battle won. So that's what I had to do. Keep it simple. Make sure I know what they're asking me, and hit the beginning, the middle, or the end to answer that question. That was pretty straightforward. And, of course, then the other thing I had to do was start to interact and surround myself with those people who were good at that. Now, someone that you know and have a lot of respect for, Malcolm X, had once said that if you ever want to know how to solve your problems, don't look at psychology, don't look at philosophy, just look at other people who are just like you, who had the same problem, and see how they solved it. Well, so that's what I tried to do. I tried to surround myself with people who were just like me, maybe had similar backgrounds, weren't super scholarly, but were on the road to scholarship, and they were doing well or a little bit better than me. And then I would gravitate toward them, and they sort of became my friend slash helper, mentor, and we went. You know, and we were, you know, we would read each other's papers, and they would make suggestions, I would make suggestions. And one of the other things that's very important, too, anytime you're in a fight or a battle, it always helps if you have somebody in there with you. So I can't overstress the importance of having study groups. If you have people who are in your corner and who are intelligent and willing to work, then you want to put them in your study group, and all of you attack the same issue, problem, class at the same time. Meet regularly. Do your homework, because you can't have any deadbeats in there or any slackers, people that don't want to do the work or half do the work. Half doing the work is just as bad as not doing it at all. So you got to be willing to – that's the, another important piece, the work ethic. I used to force myself to go into the library every Saturday and Sunday and spend a minimum of 6 hours in there on Saturday and Sunday, even if I didn't do anything. Even if I didn't do anything, I made myself – I trained myself to sit in that library. And sometimes it was very hard. Sometimes I'd finish what I had to do, and but I wouldn't go home and watch television or go home and just lay up. I'd stay there, the standard 6 hours. And I did that for 3 years in Columbia University. The first, I did that religiously. And, you know, we're creatures of habit. So that became a habit. Every weekend I was in there. And then the more I gave up, the less I gave up, because it wasn't a big thing. I wasn't giving up not going to the movies, or I wasn't giving up going to the disco. I didn't see it as that. I was on a mission, and I was accomplishing that. The movies and the disco is always going to be there. So that wasn't a big thing. I built that habit and it went on. And, of course, like anything else, the more you do it, the better you get at it. So that was the saving grace. And at the end of that, my tenure in Columbia University's master's program, I had learned how to learn. And once you do that, you can almost attack any piece of material and dissect it, put it together in your own words, regurgitate it, and look at the essence of it. What's the essence of this? And that's you can do that with almost anything. I'm not sure about the sciences now. I mean, I'm talking about calculus and physics and stuff like that. But most other things you can do that with. So that that was a big piece for me there. My second master's degree came from I was going to go to the doctoral program. I was headed to the doctoral program, and I wanted to get not a doctorate in social work, but a doctorate in psychology. So I was ready. And what happened was, while I was studying social work, there was a professor named Lynch who was a licensed psychoanalyst, and he was also a social worker. And he had a very lucrative practice, and he used to come in and bring cases and would give us each week a vignette from one of these cases. And he would, we would follow the cases with him. Each semester is about, 12, 14 weeks. So he would every week come in and read a vignette from the case, same case. And fortunately for him, because he was a psychoanalyst, he placed a premium on dreams, the patient's dreams. So he would give the dream and this vignette, or she said this, and I said that. And so that really hooked me. So I'm looking at this, and I'm saying, wow, okay, this guy has a master's degree, and he's a trained psychoanalyst. And at the end of this semester, he asked us, what did this mean? What do you think? What do you think about this patient? And, of course, we didn't know. We weren't trained in psychoanalysis or anything. So we all guessed and took guesses. And it was fun, to be very honest. And then he tied everything in together and told us what this was, this woman's unconscious desires, unconscious fears, and how it showed us very clearly how it was playing itself out in her life today. And it made so much sense. It was like somebody literally smacked me with a brick. So after class was over, I went up to him and I said, how do you do that? I want to learn how to do that. I want to learn this psychoanalysis. That is fantastic. I said, I could have never guessed that. That would have been, but it made so much sense. So he kind of smiled at me, and I guess he saw I was sincere. And he said to me, well, have you ever been in psychoanalysis? Me? No, I laughed. I said, no, I don't have the money to do that. So he said, no, I tell you what I'll do. I'll refer you to an analyst up at the Columbia Presbyterian Hospital on 68th Street, and they'll give you a sliding scale, and you'll go in there, and you'll go into analysis yourself. So I didn't want to share with him that I can only pay something like $15 or $20 a session because I don't have no money. But I went up there, like he said, and went, and the first analyst I got up there was arguing with me over the price, and he's saying, no, you can pay more than 20. You can pay $35 a session here three times a week. So I can't afford $100. And I showed him my income. He said, and he was basically, and I hate to brand this guy like this because this is the way I felt at that time, and I obviously still feel this way, but he was sort of like a tea party person. No, if you really want this, you can find a way to do this. And I'm sure I could have found some kind of way while studying and working this job that wasn't paying much, some this guy's money. But I said, it's not worth it for me to kill myself on this one. I'm really busting my behind going to school and working. So what happened, I went back to the professor and I said, I'm really sorry it didn't work out. This guy wanted me to pay $35 a session, and I could only afford a maximum $25. No. And what I did was I pulled out my W-2, and I pulled out a pay stub and showed him, see, this is what I make. And I could see this guy was really embarrassed. He almost stepped back and said, oh, that's not necessary. That's not necessary. Look, here. And he gave me another letter. He said, take this up there. And what he had done was ask for me to have another therapist, and in some beautiful, eloquent, clinical way, he said that it wasn't a good fit. So they got the letter, and they sent me to another one, Dr. Devlin, who still is to this day. And he was my analyst, and he took $20 an hour. And that was the beginning for me of my journey into psychoanalysis. He was excellent. Spot-on diagnosis and stuff, and the interpretation of dreams he did masterfully. And he also, a good analyst or even a good doctor will kind of tell you as we're going along what we're doing here, what we're doing. And that kind of helped me. He also knew I wanted to be an analyst, so... And once I got through with that experience, I wanted to apply to the doctoral program in psychology in City College. And I spoke to my grade advisor, who was the chairman of the department, Dr. Bill King. And first thing he said, well, how much money do you have? And I said, Dr. King, I'd have to get a scholarship. I don't have money for a doctoral program. And he said, well, let me suggest this to you. Let me suggest this. Go to a city university school. They're very reasonable. One of the easiest ones to get into and is very reasonable is Brooklyn College. And so I said, okay, I'll do that. And he said, get a master's degree in that and take as many universal courses, which are doctoral courses and master's courses, as you can. And then if you ace them, get the professor to write you an evaluation when you apply for the doctoral program. Good plan. So let's say we had this conversation in March or February. What happened was I'm going to apply in September. I ran across a guy who was a psychologist. He had a master's degree. No, he was working on a – yeah, he had a master's degree in psychology, but he was also pursuing a master's degree in organizational psychology at Brooklyn College. So we used to talk, and I would tell him, I'm going to come to Brooklyn College, and I'm going to pursue a master's degree in psychology, and I want to go on to get a doctorate. And he said, well, you know, we're doing this stuff in organizational psychology, and it's just like getting an MBA. There's that word to get an MBA, and I'm thinking, whoa, there's laser. And he said, and a lot of it was clinical courses, but a lot of it is group work. You ever did group work? Well, in my senior year, I did a lot of group work with Stephen Thayer, who was a group man at City College. And that prompted me. I said, well, let me go and take a couple of these courses in Brooklyn College, and I'll take some regular psych courses. So I didn't have to matriculate. I went there, and I went to the organizational psych program, and I took some courses in that. And I got, I think I took three courses, and I got two A's and one B. And I was kind of outraged about the B because the class was real easy. When I went and asked the professor, why didn't I get an A? He said, well, because you handed me one of your papers late, a day late, and I had a deadline. So I'm saying to myself, wow, that's kind of picky you. So I looked at him and smiled like, are you sure you're telling me the truth? I said, you know, because this class, I really enjoyed it. And so anyway, I took another class with him, and I aced it. To make a long story short, when I looked up, I had met all the requirements to get a master's degree in organizational psych. Also, I liked organizational psychology. So then I said, well, let me look at Columbia University and see if I should go into organizational psychology or not. And I applied to organizational psych program there. No, I applied to Columbia University's graduate school, and what I was attracted to was there were a lot of clinical courses in this program called Health and Behavior Studies. And I really got through that organizational psych without any sweat. And so I'm thinking, do I want to do a doctorate in this? Because most of the classes are very similar to what I had. By this time, I'm saying I got a clinical degree. I'm pursuing a psychoanalytic career, and I wanna get another degree on a doctoral level. So I went in the Health and Behavior Studies department, which was a real widespread department that looked at health and how it relates to behavior, health education and behavior. And it was very broad, and that's what I needed. So at that time, I was already pursuing a certification in psychoanalysis at the Postgraduate Center for Mental Health, and I was also taking courses in this doctoral program. And I finished up on the psychoanalytic piece, which was probably one of the most rewarding programs I ever been in. I had to be in psychoanalysis. And I also, at the same time, had to train and see patients. And in between that, I'm doing courses in the doctoral program at Columbia. So that was quite widespread. But it came at the right time because, like I said before, I'd learned how to learn. So therefore, it wasn't too much of a challenge to hit me with something I didn't know, and I could still do well in it. And there were enough clinical courses there, so I could, you know, I could addiction. Health psychology, things like that. So it was good. And when I completed that, I actually got what's called an in-route master's. I completed the master's curriculum, and while I was accepted into the doctoral program, I got a letter one day saying, you've completed all the master's requirements. Would you like to get a master's degree in this? And I said, you know, absolutely. So they gave me a master's in that while I was still pursuing the doctorate, and then I completed the doctoral studies after several hospitalizations. I had a bone affliction, and I had to have several operations. So that kind of covers the whole base on my academic career and the and
well,
how
Ford,
I think.
I will tell you something.
Well.
I you're my friend, so, but on the air, you're Dr. Phillips. You are a living testimony of the power to change. See, you and I were not born with silver spoons in our mouth. We were born with silver boots in our behind. But at the same time, as we constantly talk, that silver boot, which goes all the way back hundreds and, you know, I know why, you know, when we instantly clicked for the first time we met, but now I know you're probably a part of my same tribe because you're from Halifax County, your family of origin, and I'm from Campbell County and Buckingham County and Appomattox County. So who knows, we may be up from the same plantation, the same bloodline.
Absolutely.
This reparation question has come up, and one of the things that really is disturbing to me that the broad American civilization has not gone to. They don't know what we've gone through. But you know what bothers me more than anything, Dr. Phillips? We don't know what we're going through, have gone through. Not for the purpose. I'm not here for vindictiveness or anger or the revived pain. But if a person knows what he's gone through, like you knew that you grew up in Harlem and you know your journey, you can then better understand how to master that journey. You have a roadmap. So is it with the individual. People have it, also have that roadmap. Let us take a station break and tell you that we'll speak with Dr. Floyd Phillips, a psychoanalyst, and we're discussing reparations. And you can join the conversation at 805-727-7013. 805-727-7013. Those who are on the line, you can press 1, and you can make your comments. Now, one of the things I have often thought about is that something that all African Americans who come from this country should be guaranteed is the right to psychotherapy and family therapy, because the American broad society has a lot to do with our condition. This is not to blame anybody. But it is to be responsible, and part of reparation is repairing. Would you comment on that, Dr. Phillips?
Oh, I certainly think that we should be. Someone once said very recently that, well, how do you explain the difference in income of African-American people and the community at large? How do you explain the difference in disparity? How do you explain the difference in health? You know, there's some diseases, diabetes, different I can't think of renal diseases, and diabetes and these renal diseases affect African Americans at a rate of almost at the same rate. However, we get amputated, you know, 3 times as much. You know, dialysis 3 times as much. Why? Why is that? So, you know, you have to look in that, look at that, this thing where, do we believe in the health system? Well, I don't think so. Are we made to feel like we should believe in it? Ah, now that's another question. There was a study done in some Boston hospital where a doctor they used cameras. I think it was people going into doctor's office, different doctor's office in this clinical hospital, and it was found that most of the patients that were black seemed to stay in the office less time than their white counterparts. So when they asked the doctors, you know, is it true that you, the doctor, spend less time with black patients than you do white patients? Doctor says, absolutely not. Well, that's absurd. Then when they showed him the video, a guy stay in the room with you 8 minutes, and this white guy stays in there with you 15 minutes. You know, this type of stuff, this is an example I'm using. And the doctor went on to justify this by saying, oh, no, they don't ask questions. They don't ask, they just come in, yes, and they just leave. And that would have been enough for the average person to say, oh, well, the guy don't ask questions. A grown man should ask questions. But when someone said, well, as a medical professional, and you see this guy's not really taking care of himself, do you have an obligation to say to him, look, you might want to do this, you might want to do this, or do you know why this is important? Do you understand why this is important? What can I do to help you? Would you like to go and get some additional support so you can do this? That kind of stuff. And he basically said he saw the importance in that, but he didn't have time. In some cases, some people said that they would do it. Now, let's be fair here. You know, so they all take the same oath. So, you know, everybody was genuinely concerned. But now, the question I ask, because I've gone to doctor's offices, and was made to feel like I wasn't really, really, come on, let's go in and get this over and get out of here. You know, that's what to get. From the receptionist on up to the doctor. So I don't know how much of a role that plays in it, but one of the strong arguments for reparations, or at least looking at reparations, is the fact that let's look at how many of those policies and procedures and attitudes are alive and well in the policies, procedures, and attitudes today that still affect us. As if racism was gone completely, as people would have you to believe in this post-Obama era, that's one of the best things Obama did for us. He showed us that this stuff is alive and well. But you see that this stuff it does exist. And if the president can't get stuff passed, I mean, what about the little guy? What happened? The best that the little guy can hope is that he can, slip past unnoticed. Or someone takes pity, so I'll let him have the job, give it to him, please, that kind of thing. So that's pretty much, I heard a news anchor person say this, said, God bless my dear mother, but my dear mother said, if somebody's hungry enough, they'll figure out a way to get food. Well, what she didn't say was, if someone is hungry enough, they will figure out a way to get food, even if they have to take your food. But she was trying to imply that they would figure out a way to get food legally. Well, if there ain't no jobs out here, and a lot of the jobs, manufacturing jobs, were shipped to China and overseas, well, where are you going to get them? Where are you going to get
them?
And
I think there's another thing that we have to understand. Also, I was thinking about you and your father and your mother. Now, in other families where they had wealth or they had a home down somewhere where they could go to, the people fall on hard times. But they have enough wealth that they can take care of themselves. They have their own safety net. We have never, as a group, had a safety net. We never got the 40 acres, neither the mule. Many of us were gerrymandered out of the South. My parents kept their land in the South, but many of our people have had their land tricked out of them. So one of the things I think we as a people need to understand, we need to know what has happened to us. Dr. Phillips, you may be too young to remember, but I remember segregated lunch counters. I remember segregated hospitals. That's in my lifetime, and I tell you, I'm a bit over 60. So I have been affected by this. I mean, I know everybody thinks it's all kumbaya and everything is perfect, but we live in a society today that we still have the stench of white supremacy.
It's interesting that you would make that point, because some very disturbing news has come down the pipe, and it shows the research consistently among millennials, and those are people born in the early 80s up to the early 2000s, they believe that reparations is a thing of the past, and that really affects the old black people. People in their 80s or something, those people should be given reparations. But that's not an issue today. We see people as they are today. We take each individual. That's wonderful if, once again, you didn't have the policy. See, so that speaks to the ignorance that you really don't know not only what you've been through, but what you're still going through. See, if I say to this guy, you're not getting a job for the same reason that your great-grandfather didn't get one, because they have a certain quota here. I'll give you an example. Columbia University, the great institution that has taught me so much, consistently seems to, for the last 20, 30 years, only have about 10% African-Americans, roughly. Definitely not more than 50%, 15% at any time. Now, you ask.
And let me ask you this, Professor. I mean, yes, Dr. Phillips. What is the percentage of the African-American faculty members there? That's another question.
Wait, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question again.
Question is, if we talked about 10% of the student population is African-American, I'm asking the second question is, what is the percentage of the of African-Americans are employed as faculty members there?
Oh, that's even more interesting. But I would say, now, I've never taken a survey, but I would challenge somebody to tell me it certainly is not 10%. It's certainly not. I would be, if it's 5%, it's good. If it's 5%, it that would be excellent. But I seriously doubt it.
I don't wish to bash your institutional alma mater where you received three masters and a doctorate from. But please forgive me.
I got two masters and a doctorate from Columbia.
Two masters. You got the third master's from where was that from?
Brooklyn College.
Brooklyn College, okay. But, okay, the third master. But, you know, you had two master's from there and a doctorate from there, so I was a little inaccurate. But what the point is, I don't want to bash your institution, but I do know that they're beginning to buy up tremendous amount of property in West Harlem. And those are many of those places where we were able to get $900, maybe $400 or $500 apartments. Now, I know the issue becomes, I'm not here to bash Columbia University. I don't want anybody to think that I'm doing that. But there is the issue of encroachment. So, you know, and while we say everything is all hokadori, everything is kumbaya, there is still the residual, if not the direct effects, of slavery. Again, you know, what happened to my mother is a part and parcel of what the historical sociologist Orlando Patterson called the rituals of blood. We wonder why there's so much violence in the city of Chicago. Well, if you trace those people in Chicago back to Mississippi, they are the children of Emmett Till.
Right.
So it's very easy to learn, to understand. I mean, as a psychoanalyst, we always talk about taking a case history. First thing we want to know, what brings you? But second thing we want to get a genogram. So background, family, familiar history is vitally important. So would you share with us something about that as it relates to the reparation question?
Yes, a number of things there. Which one? One of the first things that struck me what you said was that, you know, I don't care how much or how nice somebody is. I don't want them to necessarily own my community. I should have a say in my community. I should have a piece of my community. So that creates a problem. They do own a lot of real estate in Harlem and around Harlem, and so that's an interesting phenomenon in and of itself. And how much can we afford to live there? That's another question, because the rent is very, very high. Now, they'll tell you that the last time I heard, well, we're using this for professors and for students. But how many of those students live in Harlem or from Harlem? I had a professor in Columbia University that was trying to give the scholarships that was available for our department, and she wanted to attract students who had scholarships to Ivy League schools outside of Columbia University. And I said to her, oh, no, absolutely not. I wouldn't do that if I had to vote on that. And she said, who would you give it to? I said, well-deserving poor people right here in this community from Harlem, from New York. And, we never did come to an understanding on that, because she felt that, you know, if someone was slated to go to Harvard and she could convince them to come there and give them the scholarship, I didn't see the benefit of that. I really didn't. Let them go to Harvard, especially if they were a person of color. Let them go. And you give this money to someone right here. I mean, I didn't see that. Why? Let's spread it around. Let's have them in Harvard, Cornell, MIT, whatever we can. But don't take their students and bring them here. I didn't see, when you have a wealth of people in the surrounding communities that were very talented, very determined, and needed to break. Once again, you remember, we're trying to break that 10% quota, or whatever that is there. I did ask one of the professors in Columbia University, I said, you know, when you look at the first day I ever walked into Columbia and to now, you're almost talking about 15 years of coming and going and getting these degrees. But consistently, it has remained around about 10-12%. I don't even think it was 12%, about 10% of the people here are African Americans. I wonder, is that what Du Bois was calling the talented tenth? I mean, why is it that it just remains 10%? And his answer was so profound and so honest. He said to me, well, why are you worried about that? You're in here. You know, and I said, oh, you know what? That's an excellent point. And I walked away saying to myself, does this guy know what he just said to me? Like, never mind those people out there. You're in here now. You're lucky enough to be here. Don't rock the boat. That's the way I took it. So, and you asked me a second question, but I don't remember it, Alfred. So can you kind of remind me?
I'm interested in the question of economics, of inherited poverty, and how these safety valves. I was thinking of your family, and I think of people, you know, your father being ill because he worked to build the tunnels throughout New York City, and your mother passing early on. And other families where they are more established people, there's enough wealth in the family to take care of precarious situations. And I want you to speak to this whole economic thing. We talked earlier about reparations, I mean, how economics was affected when we said romance without finance is a nuisance. And one of the reasons many African-American men can't get married or can't stay stable because they don't have the kind of jobs. Now, I used to be against reparations. Never really against it, but never had teased it out. But I think that there's still that discussion should be put back on the table. I've said a lot. I just want you to comment, and I want to ask others to join the conversation at 805-727-7013. We're speaking with Dr. Floyd Phillips. Dr. Phillips is a psychoanalyst and professor, and we're just teasing out the issues of reparations and also the repairing of the African-American psyche. My good friend and dear colleague, Brother Hakeem Hassan, one of our leading intellectuals, has opined once when I was discussing about do for self. He said, Brother Muhammad, the first thing you have to do is repair the social psychology. So I'm hoping if he's on the line, he would join this discussion as we tease through the issue of psychological reparation as it relates to the economics. I may ask too many questions, but I know you and I can keep up with each other, and you can reflect on that for a moment.
Okay, yeah. Well, there's absolutely no question in my mind. You got to do some repairing. That's what reparations is. You know, you got to do some repairing, and you got to look at what effect has that had. Now, when you deny people resources, okay, you're going to have a breakdown. If I deny you clean water, as you see what's going on in Africa, you're going to create sickness, disease, and maybe even death. So the holding back of resources. There was an early lawsuit done. Well, I think the guy was in Chicago or Detroit, and he got out of the army and he wanted to step up into the middle class. He was working and everything, but he could not get a loan for a house. And there was not a whole lot of development going on in his community for private houses because the government wasn't putting money in there. So when you hold back certain resources, you can create poverty. You don't actually have to go in there and beat people up or degrade them. Hold back on just supplies. Hold back on sanitation. So instead of the garbage man coming to pick up the garbage twice a week in your neighborhood, they come in once a week to pick it up. Or let me stretch my example to better make my point. They come in once every 2 weeks to pick up the garbage. What kind of stench, what kind of apathy, what kind of disease, what kind of problems you think you would have just from that? Just from that. So if they hold back on decent hospitalization, decent schooling, all of these things, as you said, have an effect. But look at the problems that it would cause and the apathy. There's that word. You know, Brother Muhammad, I'm fond of saying to people that a man can live 2 months without food and then he'll die. A man can live 1 month without water, and then he'll die. But no man can live one day without hope. So when you start to take people's hope away, and that apathy sets in, and apathy usually is accompanied by anger, when that sets in, now you have a problem. You have a problem. Soon people will lose sight of, some people, of who the real problem is. The person that took this stuff away from me, or the people that I have to compete with what's limited right here for. And you usually take your anger out on the closest person to you. So that's the person that they go for. So you have teenagers shooting old people or shooting each other on a wholesale level. But if you take those things away from them, in the richest city in probably in the world, you know, what happens? I love Mount Sinai Hospital, but not for the reason you may think. Mount Sinai Hospital is a wonderful institution for certain people. But Mount Sinai, if you walk out on the Fifth Avenue side, which is the west side of Mount Sinai, and you walk out of the building and you walk five blocks to your left, you hit the richest zip code in New York City. If you walk out of that same exit on Fifth Avenue and walk five blocks to your right, you hit the poorest zip code or one of the poorest zip codes in New York City. And all of those people share the emergency room and some parts of that hospital. Now, you need to know that that hospital, if I remember my research, the federal government had looked at them very closely because they seemed to have a two-tier system of medicine when it came to treating people of color in that hospital. They treated them, but they didn't have the exact same stuff that was available to other people. I don't have the article in front of me, but I remember the article. Let me see.
You know, Dr. Phillips, I know for a fact I have a family member that has Medicaid, has two master's degrees, but she's fallen on hard times and she had to go to Mount Sinai. They actually segregate the hospital. The Medicaid patients have been put on certain floors. Before I start passing the word to people to go to Mount Sinai and go to these hospitals, I passed the word. I used to tell people, because Medicaid costs, the best thing to do is go to the East Side Hospital. Well, after maybe 10 years of passing that word, now they pretty much shut out persons that are in that surrounding neighborhood. So would you continue to discuss an even medical apartheid?
Right. Well, that's all part of. That's all part of. Once again, what I said before. Our good friend, Brother Curtis Evans, will tell you a very heart wrenching story of how his father was in a hospital in Georgia with cancer when he was a little boy in the early '60s, late '50s, early '60s, and how badly the nurses treated him when his mother would say, "Your father's in pain, go down the hall and ask the nurse to come here." And the nurse would ignore him. And he would just stand there as a young man and say, "Excuse me, miss." And the lady said, "Well, I'm doing something now. Can you wait?" And he would stand there for like 10 or 15 minutes. And then when he would tell her what he wanted, she'd say, "Okay, I'll be down there. Just go back." And it was so sad. But speaking of reparations, which most people will just say reparation of slavery, those policies, procedures, and attitudes still affect medicine to this day. The policy in medicine, the attitude in medicine. You see, so therefore, you're right. We have to look at what that does to us. Because for every action, there's some kind of reaction.
You know, I teased out, too, Doctor, is that a lot of us take our anger out on each other, trying to make an explanation for what has happened. We put a lot of blame on ourselves. And that's what it made me to be such a compassionate person. The field of psychoanalysis has made me not to get angry at my mom. And if I were not aware of psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, I would be angry. My mother was a very cruel woman. Reminded me very much of Richard Wright's, of the book that Richard Wright called Demented Genius. But when I understand that my mother is a child of slavery, that which was the most cruelest and horrific system ever to be known to man or woman or whatever you were using, I developed compassion for her. That she was trying to destroy her own child because that child had come into masculinity and had a mind. Well, why would a slave need a mind? So my mother was doing just naturally, or as E. Franklin Frazier called it, mother in bondage. So what we see happening on the streets of Martin Luther King Boulevard throughout these United States of America is a direct result of slavery. Now, a lot of people say, well, just because you escaped, just because you don't have that mind, just because you had a solid home, and there are some of us did have that. But there are many people that didn't have that. So it seemed to me I should have that compassion. In fact, my anger is directed more at the people who run those institutions who took property from us. Well, anyway, I don't want to get into a rant, but I just wanted to tease out that how the victim, how people victimize themselves and blame some of the people that they have to share the same space with. Can you explain that?
You know, it's very easy. It's easier and more effective to blame the people next door to you. And, you know, you hear people use the N-word and say, there's a guy from the Midwest. He's an African-American guy. And I don't know what we were talking about one day, but it was something that another African-American person did in Columbia University that we particularly didn't care for. And he surprised me by saying, well, you know what my mother always say? And I said, no. He said, my mother said, nigger under the hood, car no good. And that, you know, I had to say to him, brother, well, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that this is something indicative that black people do. I'm saying that one individual person is kind of misguided. But no, brother, I can't. Because, you know, if I saw you fixing something, I wouldn't say, oh, there it is. It's going to be messed up, if, you know. And so we have to get away from blaming the victim. Because it's easier to blame him than blame ourselves. See, we're not like that end. See, we're a different kind of end. You know, it reminded me also of another story that a Latino friend of mine told me. He said his father was in the military during the Vietnam War. And he said that his father went to some bar in Georgia or South Carolina, I don't know, and he walked in the bar. He was Puerto Rican, and he asked for a drink. And the bartender said, excuse me, sir, I don't want any trouble here, but we don't serve niggas in here. And the Puerto Rican guy stepped back and said to him, whoa, I'm Puerto Rican. And the bartender said to him, listen, I don't care what kind of nigga you are, you're not white. And please leave, you know. So it was an eye-opener for him.
You know, funny thing you said that. I knew a Puerto Rican guy, I'm going to leave him nameless. But he was a brown-skinned, very dark-skinned Puerto Rican guy. And he told me the same story. He said that happened to him in Oklahoma. He said,
right.
You know, and while we know, I won't name this legislature, a very dark-skinned Puerto Rican legislator in the Bronx, remained nameless, told me the same story. I said, man, you look just like me. He said, well, brother, don't tell me that because that's what happened to me in Oklahoma. They told him the same thing. So this color consciousness and this white supremacy attitude, many of us have internalized it and actually exhibit that kind of hatred to each other. Now, you can join the conversation at 805-727-7013. If you would join me a moment, pardon me, indulge me a moment, as I read from, I don't know the correct pronunciation of this brother's name, but I know his name is Coates. What is Nahisa Coates of the Atlantic Monthly? All right.
Yes.
But I'm going to read an excerpt from and ask you to comment. They talk a lot about slavery. When people hear reparations, quote, end quote, they automatically think what's being discussed is reparations for slavery. Coates doesn't talk about slavery in the piece, and particularly, he notes the story of a formerly enslaved woman named Belinda Royal, who sued her former owner for recompense for her labor. But much of this focus falls on American housing policy from nearly a century later, events that had happened within living and even recent memory. In the years following World War II, the economy was booming. Suburbs were popping up thanks to a new federal highway system, and millions of Americans availing themselves of government-backed home loans. World War II veterans used their GI bills, benefits to pay for college or start their lives. The government was essentially subsidizing the creation of America's huge middle class. Unless you were black, Coates outlines a constellation of ways that African Americans were thoroughly shut out of that expansion of wealth. He spends much more time on the events of the 20th and 21st century than he does on the antebellum period. To Coates, one needn't go back as far as slavery to see officially sanctioned and occasionally violent opposition to black wealth creation. Now, next week we're going to tease out the Tulsa massacre. They call it the Tulsa riots. But 300 of our people were massacred in the process of those people creating the American dream. So I really wonder, Professor Dr. Phillips, if you would tease that out, these impediments to establishing that something, and reflect on Mr. Coates' article.
Well, and what he's saying is very valid. What his article really talks about is that, okay, let's not even do what's owed in reparations. Let's not even do who should get it or why is it necessary. Let's just look and have a healthy, open, honest discussion about, you know, what was done, who was it done to, and what was the result of it. Should there be any benefits that could help today to repair this stuff? You see, once again, the word reparation has repair in there somewhere. So let's have a healthy discussion. And if you have an open and honest discussion, which doesn't seem, I mean, today, having an honest discussion is like the guy in Greek mythology who walked around looking for an honest man with a lantern in the daytime. It's very hard to have an honest, open discussion with people about this kind of stuff. My mentor used to say that the guilty flee when none pursue. Let's just have an open, honest discussion. Just as sure as Holocaust survivors today get certain benefits, certain things, and they're certainly entitled to them. I think that African Americans should be given some basic minimum things. I thought it was an excellent idea that you have the affirmative action program so that a certain amount of colleges, people of color could get into college. That's certainly a step. But you mean to tell me now with all of the I'll show you a parallel example. This I think that's very clear. You can elect a black man into the highest office of the land, but if we use policy and procedure, we will nullify his power and not let him get many significant things through. You see, so that's you elected him. We let you elect him. It was a fair election. But look at the policies and procedure that the Tea Party, and we don't have to say too much about them, I hope, that they use to nullify.
And, you know, a brother was on the radio program yesterday, and he said when they got tired of the Tea Parties, as the white supremacist power structure always has done, they bring these wild animals out when they need them. They bring the Klan out when they need them. And Right. Now they're tired of them. They have pushed them away. So all the Tea Party was just a false party from the beginning. It was created by Dick Armitage and various right-wing white supremacist think tanks. So
well,
this is
I
not,
agree with
this,
that. But
this is not an authentic uprising. This is just merely a political device, no different than what they use with the Klan and other groups to intimidate us.
Right. But now, and I agree with you. And remember, they don't need the Tea Party anymore because Obama is going out. I mean, the next person getting in is not going to be black. It's going to be white. So you don't need a Tea Party. You can't use the same tactics on a white woman, because I think Hillary Clinton is going to get in, that you use on Obama. You can't use the same code words we're going
to
take out.
Well, you know, I hate
back
to say this, and I don't mean to interrupt you. I suspect Hillary Clinton won't be too much different than most other Caucasians. See,
well,
you know,
but
and this
what
is an issue that I think some of us should discuss. I grew up in the South, and a lot of us said, well, you know, Caucasian women are better. I have never found that much difference, really. Not that I'm not here or against Ms. Clinton. But I do know that Emmett Till is dead because of a white woman. I know that many other African-American men are now soaked in the Tallahatchie River and many other rivers, and the soil of the strange fruit hanging on those trees was a result of white women and them socializing their kids to white supremacy. So I don't know where this idea comes, which I think is a false idea, of African-American really seeing Caucasian women as our friends. I think matriarch and patriarch, Jane and Jim Crow have been both prominent on our neck. I'm sorry.
Well, I agree with you. I certainly don't think Hillary Clinton is going to be our savior. I do not. But my main point is that they're not going to use the same tactics or Hillary Clinton that they use.
No, no, she's part of the club. If this was only, now I'm here as the interview, but I will say this: No, they would have never used that against her. They may use tactics against, this is an internecine Caucasian warfare that they gave, but they would never use the vicious Berlin attack. Or as Mitch McConnell said, we're going to break him. Now, you may not know that language, but I grew up in the South. If you say you're going to break somebody, that means like you broke a horse. That means they're going to break President Obama. They're glad, they surprised now that he hasn't committed suicide. This is the intent. And also to explore the idea of African Americans ever coming into leadership. But guess what? They are wrong. We have a caller from 201-344. I believe it's the historical sociologist Hakeem Hassan. Welcome to Religion Means a Lie.
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen, and Dr. Phillips. Did I have your name correctly? Because I
tuned in. Yes, sir.
Yeah, so it's a pleasure to hear your voice and your man's voice. And there are a lot of moving pieces to what both of you are talking about. I just want to say a couple of things because I found what you were saying about Columbia interesting. I was just at Columbia the other day at a graduation. And they have another tradition up at Columbia called Black Graduation, which is an event in which the, quote, black, end of quote, graduates have kind of like a private ceremony. And that's interesting in and of itself because the students who participate in that are not what you might classify as black American born stateside solely. They are students across what you might loosely refer to as the diaspora, meaning students from various nations in Africa,
okay.
Students from Jamaica and other places in the Caribbean, as well as Latin students. That's what I saw with my own two eyes.
Now, let me just ask this question, brother, because what you're saying is very interesting. I think I know what you're talking about. Are you talking about the graduation that they hold at the church? It's usually under Teachers College?
In this case, they held it in some auditorium on Columbia's campus. And I don't want the listeners to get this incorrectly. It wasn't a separate graduation for the black students. This is a ceremony, as I understand it, as part of a tradition that was established, I think, through Afro-Am and what have you. But these students graduate with the general student body. These are undergraduate students.
Okay.
So while I was there, there were a number of parents, black American parents, in the audience, one of whom got up because his daughter just graduated, and he indicated that he was a part of five black American students who were at Columbia in the 1960s. He said there were only five students. And he said, you can imagine what that was like. Mm-hmm. There was another parent that got up. He said he graduated in 81. His brother graduated in 71. And his daughter was just a part of this ceremony. So part of what I want to say is that you have the complication of class, place, and a lot of variables that also play into this idea of a certain percentage of what is considered to be black students in these elite institutions. If you talk to a lot of these students, you ask them where they come from, what their parents do, increasingly you will find that a good number of these students are not from poor families. Mm-hmm. Their parents are professional folks. Mm-hmm. And this is now, in my view, kind of reshaping how we look at diversity in American education vis-a-vis the whole question of ethnicity and race. This whole question of class is now being brought into the discussion, and I think to a large extent it is eclipsing the chances and the possibility of folks who come from poor neighborhoods, poor families, and that sort of thing. So that's one thing I wanted to bring to your attention, because I thought that was quite interesting. And from my observational point of view, I sat there for about 2 hours. It was just simply fascinating to watch all of this going on. Mm-hmm. When they were talking about black students, they had students in there from Ghana, Nigeria, from Jamaica, from literally all over the world. There are places in Columbia, in terms of the professors, there are departments like in econ where there are no black American professors, so far as I know, that are tenured or whatever the case may be. Very few. Mm-hmm. When you get into certain disciplines across the academy, well, I suspect if you eliminate it or downsize Afro-Am throughout the country, then the number of professors, that is to say black American professors who are in the academy, the percentages would probably drop precipitously, you know, as far as from what I could see. And the other thing is, so I scanned the Coates article, because there's an exchange going on between Coates and another fellow named Jonathan Chayet, who used to be one of the editors at the New Republican at New York Magazine, and they've been having this exchange in print. So Coates has been doing all of these talk shows, Bill Moyers, and what have you, because this whole idea of what he's articulating has been quite important and hot and all of that sort of stuff. But the seminal part of his essay has to do with housing, his housing history in this country. He says 60 years or so of discriminatory housing policy, and he alludes to the work of Douglas Massey, Nancy Denton, who wrote a book called American Apartheid, and, of course, a study that they did. He teaches at Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all really, really critical in terms of understanding how this continuum has played itself out up to this present day. When you read the history, and there's a tremendous literature on this, local and federal housing policy, it is mind-blowing to begin to grasp the extent to which the government, working in tandem with some of the elite institutions, University of Chicago, and other institutions around this country, to move our folks into, quote-unquote, these ghettos with virtually no possibility of getting out. Then you add the other twist of it, of a kind of occupational and economic American apartheid, where people are not allowed en masse to move into certain positions where they can make certain money, or for that matter, even earn a living that would allow them certain socioeconomic mobility. Finally, you raise this issue of my community. And I always try to figure out what the my means. Is that an allusion to a kind of cultural, emotional assessment, or that has to do with any notion of what we actually own? You know, J. Paul Getty said the meek shall inherit the earth, but not his mineral rights. That was one of the things he often said. And so I'm wondering what we mean by my community, when in fact a lot of these communities, if you look at it from the perspective of apartment buildings and housing and what have you, within the framework of economics, these things are seen as commodities that are bought and sold, and they're largely owned by people who don't live in these neighborhoods ostensibly, and these outsiders, that is to say these profound economic interests, are the ones that are dictating what happens where we live for the most part, which in essence makes many of us almost tourists. Mm-hmm. But I want to thank both of you for this enlightening discussion, and I just wanted to make those comments.
I appreciate the comments, brother, and it's very relevant. I have... I have attended many graduations, you probably guess, up there at Columbia University, and I've gone into a few, and like you said, based on the departments and curriculum, there seems to be a disproportionate number of people of color, and there's a tremendous amount of students from around the world in Columbia University of color. So I agree with that assessment. I don't know particularly which graduation you're speaking about, but I know that there is one main graduation that they hold outdoors if the weather permits it, and usually everyone can attend that. Then
Columbia must have had, I don't know, you can go on their website and see this, they must have had 8 or 9 or 10 different commencements and graduations from different schools up there, out finished exactly where you walk through the main gates on 116th Street and go straight through in I guess you could call it the Great Square. They had all that set up, and it was kind of hot that day. So you're right, they had that. This thing I'm alluding to, which I didn't even know existed, is a separate event that I guess is held for what they characterize as the black students. So I didn't even know what that meant until I got further clarification on it. So it's not a graduation. It's more like a celebratory kind of an event where these students of color get together with their families and friends and just talk about, their experience at the school and what have you. It was very moving, to say the least. I found it to be interesting.
Listen, if you can get any information on that, I'd like to know a little bit more about that, because, first of all, next time I'd like to show up with my doctoral cap and gown on there and just attend that, if you can.
Right.
If you want to, you can email me. I'm at the New York Institute of Health and Behavior, NYIHB.org. NYIHB.org, that's the New York Institute of Health and Behavior. And just, remind me of who you were and that we spoke. And if you want to, we can keep in touch. But if you email me that information, I certainly would like to look at and pass it on to other folks of color who graduated with me. And I promise you, next year, we'll show up there with bells on. And I'll try to participate as much as I possibly can. If you're an alumni of Columbia University and you're a doctor, you can kind of walk through their graduation time with your cap and gown on and go on in almost any one of those events. So I would like to do that and give some support if I can to that organization.
Yes. Well, I'll do that. Also, there were I think there was someone who was from Columbia, something, I'm just saying it's loosely, Columbia Black Alumni Association or something. It was a man who was from that. So what I'm saying is, in that singular sense, is that there are people who have set up these support mechanisms for these students that they can draw upon to help get through the institution. Because it's very rigorous, and as you pointed out on the show, it's only a handful statistically of these students who are in these places, and it could be quite daunting.
Oh, yeah. Well, you see it a lot. You see it a lot, and I think it's beautiful. You see it a lot with Asian students. You can take Asian students from anywhere, and bring them together in a university, and they're like magnets. They will come together and give each other support. It's a very beautiful thing, and it works well. As I said earlier in the broadcast, I can't overstate the importance of studying in groups. I really can't, and for a lot of reasons, the work gets done, but it's also the emotional, psychological support. So that helps a lot. There's really the average person has average intelligence, and what really makes a difference is how hard you work and if you stick to it. Consistency and sticking to it and the support you have, that will get you over it. That will help you and push you right over the hump if you're having a hard time. So I can't say enough about that.
Right. Mm-hmm. But the discussion itself was great, and I have to read the entire essay that Coates has written. I think it's like 15,000 words.
Right, right, right. I'm also going to reach out to him and say, because he was talking about this guy who keeps putting this bill up there and they won't even vote on it, to explore reparations and what it's done, et cetera, that we in the community should get together and do our own research. And then that would be a preliminary to put forth, well, this is what we saw. What about looking at this or starting from here? What do you think, if nothing else, what do you think about the research? Is it valid? Did we do a good job? I mean, the scholarship, is it there? And just to start the ball, you know, if people don't want to do something for you, you try to do it for yourself and say, well, look what I came up with. That's one of the reasons why when they were going to form this committee to look at Benghazi, and the Democrats said, well, we're going to boycott it because it's a jive nonsense committee. Somebody said, Hillary Clinton actually asked them, no, don't let them go in a room by themselves and close the door and do this. Because when they come out, God knows what they're going to come out with, and they're going to say, we had a valid meeting. Have some people in there that's going to be a monitor for truth and for justice. You got to have somebody sitting in there, you know, from the other side to say, no, look, this is not being done right, and et cetera, et cetera. So I think that if they don't want to, they keep downvoting this bill and they won't let it go through, then I think people from the community, we have enough scholars to sit down and do this on our own and come up with, well, this is what we came up with. You know, if you ever want to know how to get rid of roaches, sir, the best way to get rid of roaches is just shine the light on them, and they'll run. So, you know, you keep stuff in their face and you know, the truth. And Malcolm said you don't need a switchblade to chase a dishonest man down the street. Just use the truth, and he'll run every time. So that's all. We just conduct our own research and come back with it. But I plan to reach out to that brother and see what he's talking about and what he want to do.
Right. Yeah, he's been on the
Brother, I wanted to ask you, Doctor, about the issue. You didn't have a high school diploma. You went through the College Adaptive Program.
Yeah.
Also, during the period the College Adaptive Program was going on, there was another school operating called the Harlem Prep. And I think these compensatory programs are still needed. Would you agree? And as you close out, would you make a comment on that?
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting you mentioned Harlem Prep, because I went there for about a year and I left for other reasons, not because of anything about the school.
Could you tell us something about Harlem Prep? This is one of the vital institutions that existed in Harlem flourished during the 60s and 70s.
Right. Harlem Prep was sort of like a street academy, and it was for bright people who wanted a education but didn't quite fit into mainstream education for whatever reason. One of the reasons that some people drop out is because the schools, you know, are not keeping up with them. In other words, they're very sharp, but it's not being taught in a way that stimulates them, and they kind of lose interest and don't do their homework, and then they run head on into the institution and the teacher, so they kind of drop out. And Harlem Prep was an alternative to that, where you had a lot of grassroots scholars, Dr. Ben, and folks like that would teach there, and you would go there and you'd not only learn about the mainstream education, but about your community and yourself and African history, and that was very stimulating. You could apply it to everyday life. So you definitely need transitional schools. You just can't have one size fits them all, you know. And also too, I wish we had a Harlem Prep for young people. I mean, Jeffrey Canada and doing great things up there with the Harlem Children's Zone, but we need something like that, where if you start from infancy, you know, you and I discussed earlier, but if you can teach kids when they're young that there's no such thing as failure, this is just another way of learning what not to do or putting.
And, you know, I'm also concerned about the Dr. Claude Phillips and the Raw, who are in the neighborhood. They may even be in the alley somewhere right now smoking weed, and they may not really want to be in that alley, but no one has turned them on. I know you didn't come with a house full of books. I know something about your background. You didn't come from a house with a bunch of professors, but somehow or another you had a desire. And I believe we can put that desire in these young people. Some of them are homies. But homie, I remember meeting a homie, and the man was an orderly in the hospital, and he had no teeth in his mouth, and he was working as an orderly in the hospital. And I was in one of Mr. Muhammad's temples in Washington, D.C., and I had given a lecture, and I came off the rostrum, and I told him, I said, you know what,
what do you do for a living? I didn't know this man from Adam's Health Care, as the old word goes. He said, I'm an orderly. I said, you ever thought of the fact that you could be more than an orderly? I said, you ever thought of the fact you could be a physician? He said, no, I never thought of that. I said, well, then, what's your educational background? For 5 minutes, I just teased out and gave him a one-on-one counseling session. He said, well, you know, I barely can read. I've been taught about the seventh grade. And so I later on followed his career where he went to a reading program so he could become literate. Then he hit the motivation. This man went from basic adult basic education to a GED program. And so he said, well, Brother Muhammad, I'm still not college material. But I said, well, go to a junior college, try that out. Take one course at that. Bottom line, this man took him about 10 years to get a bachelor's. Lo and behold, I was at a conference. I lost touch with him. I was at a conference in Louisville. He said, you don't remember me, do you? I said, no. I said, yeah, I do. But, I mean, actually, to tell you the truth, I remembered him in spirit. I didn't remember him because he looked altogether different. He had teeth in his mouth. I remember the guy that was disheveled talking rapidly. And this man is a board-certified internal medicine person. And I believe that we go into these neighborhoods to inspire people, people who are Floyd-filled, people who are Alfred Muhammad, who may or may not be on the straight path. But if somebody stopped by there to just prophesy, I'm saying prophesy in some spooky sense, but see their potential and speak to their potential. That's why I'm supporting Brother Adib Shaker with the Father, Son, Men, and Boys Association. Because I believe we got to get street academies. I believe that we have to open up prep schools. I believe we have to have summer camps because we have to change the very nature of the mind. And until reparation comes, we have to repair our own people. I thank you, Dr. Phillips. I thank our honorable and noble guests for being on the air. Now, tomorrow at 3 o'clock, I invite every one of you to tune in. I need each one of you to call up 10 people. Now, just call up 5 and tell them I have a very special message. I know unemployment is high in our community. I know illiteracy is high in our community. I know that we have 1 out of 3 people in jail in our community. I know all of these bleak facts, but I also know that there is solution to the financial and emotional pollution. I ask you to tune in tomorrow. Dial in 805-727-7013. Organizing for success will be my topic. Organizing for success, and if we can argue our case before our own soul, I'm convinced we will argue our case before the world court, and God will be blessed. Dr. Phillips, it has been an honor and a privilege on short notice for you to be on the program, and you will return because next time we're going to continue the topic of psychoanalysis in the reeducation process. How do we take a Dr. Phillips from no degree to 2-3 masters and a PhD degree? I believe that we can replicate that success methodology. Do you believe that, Doctor?
Oh, I know we can. I know we can.
All right,
I can't remember the great scholar, but someone once said it's easier to create a perfect child than to fix a broken adult. So I certainly think that we can do this. We can definitely do this.
Thank you, Dr. Phillips. Thank you, honorable and noble listening audience. Next week we're going to have a place you can send us some money because we need money to be on the air. This program is not free. Mr. Alan Levy is a very fine man, but if I don't pay this broadcast fee every month, some of you know where you can send the donation. Let me tell you, until we have the post office box up, you can send it to Imam Alfred Muhammad, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, 07036. Now, I'm going to be calling some of you right now on the broadcast tomorrow because we're in a real cash crunch. Repeat that. Imam Alfred Muhammad, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, 07036. We advertise in the Muslim Journal. We owe the Amsterdam News money for their advertising. It's not free, but Mr. Levy got to get his money from Blog Talk Radio, so we need you to send your donation. Thank you, dear beloved people, and we look forward to seeing you tomorrow at 3 o'clock on Religion Means Alive. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience.